The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
We have made a start by a wind. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday evening California time space show program. If you happen to be in Tokyo, which is where our guest is, it would be the Wednesday morning space show program. It's great to be here after our long holiday weekend for the Labor Day period here in the United States. And thank all of you for tuning in. A couple of very quick announcements. First of all, it's a full week of programming. And Hotel Mars, Stephanie Thomas of Princeton Satellite Systems is returning. Mr. Batchelor wants to explore fusion energy, since I talked to him about our show with Princeton and Stephanie from a couple of weeks ago. So Hotel Mars will focus on fusion tomorrow, and of course that's a pre-record. Hope to have it up on the website by Friday. And for the show today, we're planning a 60-minute format. But again, if you are calling us, if you're active, we will keep it going. So note that it is a 60-minute plan format, but hopefully the telephones will ring, which is what we like on a talk show. Our phone number is 1-866-687-7223, and email, of course, at drspace@thespaceshow.com. For other business, all of our newsletters are up and posted for the week, and you can find them on our homepage. Also, quickly, I just want to call your attention to the fact that we are a listener-supported program. We're a nonprofit 501c3. Our parent is One Giant Leap Foundation. And listeners, just like those of you listening to this show, do support us. And that's what allows the Space Show to have great guests like the one we have tonight with us, but other great guests as well. So if you are a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift to the Space Show. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax donation, as we're a California public benefit corporation. Our guest today, one other thing. We do have sponsors. So I want to mention our sponsors, since this is a shorter format. I just want to shout out to our great sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. We would not be doing our program without the sponsor support. If you're interested in being a sponsor, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Your messages on the longer shows stay with all the programs and stay on all of the archives, so they last a very long time, probably into perpetuity, maybe. And if you want to have your message out there, again, give us a call, and you also get those banner ads going across the homepage that you see, which you can change whenever you want. So once again, the best way to find out about sponsorship is to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So our guest today is returning guest Chris Blackerby, and he is the Group Chief Operating Officer at Astroscale, and he is based in Tokyo. His full bio is up on the website, so I'm just going to urge you to read about him. But Astroscale is involved in debris removal from orbits in space and the life extension of various space hardware, satellites, etc. And a lot has happened since Chris was with us in March of 2019. It's almost 3 years. Wow. Long time, Chris. Welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm great, David. It is a long time, and man, a lot has happened since March of 2019, not just for us, but was a quite a different world back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But why don't we limit it to what's happened with Astroscale? Because otherwise, we'd probably be here for the rest of the month.
We only have 60 minutes.
Yeah, what has been happening? I get your press releases, and Allison is great at sending them out, and I also thank her for helping to put this show together. So I know lots has been going on, and it's real exciting, and I follow it, so share it with the audience.
Sure. Well, thanks again for the opportunity. It's great to be back on here, and yeah, we have a wonderful MarComms team, marketing communications team, that includes Allison, that is out there spreading the word with a newsletter every month and lots of activity online. So definitely a place to check out more information in addition to what I'm going to talk about here. So first, last time we spoke, 2.5 years ago, what did Astroscale look like then? I can't recall exactly where we were at that time, but probably about 100 people globally. We had raised about $100 million, and we were really focused on this mission called ELSA-D, which is our mission in orbit right now, end-of-life services by Astroscale demonstration. That was our main mission at that time. And we were, I think, a different company in some ways, and but still with some very clear similarities to where we are now. So in terms of the differences, where we are now, we basically doubled in size in terms of number of team members, and in terms of amount of capital raised through the venture markets. We've now raised about $191 million U.S., and we have over 200 people. I don't know. The numbers change all the time, as you know, but probably 210 or so around the world. Also, at the time in March, we had primarily offices in the U.S., I'm sorry, in Japan and the U.K. Soon after our conversation in March of that year, we opened up our third big office. We also have a back office in Singapore, but we opened up our next big office in the U.S. We opened up an office based in Denver, Colorado, with additional staff in Washington, D.C., and have expanded that U.S. office from one person back when we last spoke to now about 35 people in our U.S. office, primarily located in Denver, but also in D.C., additionally, we acquired a company last year in 2020, the March-April time frame, a little bit later. We acquired a company in Israel, we placed that organizationally under our U.S. branch, and that U.S. and Israel group is focused on, as you mentioned in your introduction, life extension services for satellites, primarily in the geo orbit, which is something we have not been focused on up until about a year and a half ago. We expanded our service offerings to include that life extension aspect. Now, with that expansion, we have multiple missions under development or in operation. So I mentioned the ELSA-D mission, end-of-life services by Astroscale demonstration. That's the mission that's in orbit right now. And you mentioned a successful demonstration, which we had a couple weeks ago, where this satellite in orbit, which is actually two satellites connected together, the larger servicing satellite released the smaller satellite, which is our stand-in for debris, and captured it. It was a huge step, David. It's hard to articulate how big of a deal this is, that we were able to separate, even though it was a very short separation time and distance. We were able to test out the sensors, the capabilities on our servicing satellite. We're able to apply a thrust to the servicer and move in and capture that client satellite using a magnet. It's a big deal that a company like us, a privately funded company, not a government R&D mission, was able to demonstrate this in orbit. So we're really excited about that, and we can talk more about that later.
Was this in low Earth or in LEO?
It was in LEO, yeah, David. It was at about 550 kilometers altitude, and we launched it in March of this year, and over the last few months I've been going through various checkout procedures, and this was the first of what's going to be multiple demonstrations to prove the capability to capture an object in LEO. So over the next several months, we'll be doing more in terms of releasing and capturing this piece of debris to prove out various technologies that we have in rendezvous and proximity operations in LEO.
What do you do when you capture it? What do? You just turn it around and release it like you're going fishing and you throw the fish back?
Basically it, but with, yeah, that's basically it. But then we're going to keep grabbing it again. So we're going to, it's connected right now. The stack is back to its two satellite stack. We're going to release it, go a little farther away next time, move up, capture it again, do the same thing one more time, and put a spin on it so we can simulate what would be an out-of-control piece of debris. And once we demonstrate all of those capture capabilities, we're going to deorbit the entire stack. So this is a full technology demonstration. We're not removing any debris right now. We're just demonstrating that we are building the capabilities to do so in the future.
So when you capture enough, then you deorbit it. Is that the game plan?
When we prove our multiple capabilities in terms of capture, yes, we will deorbit the entire stack. So we will reduce it using our remaining fuel. We will reduce the altitude, bring it lower so we can reduce the time in orbit, and then it will burn up on reentry. What we're doing here, though, is we're testing out the capabilities for rendezvous and proximity operations to find these things and also to attach to them. So that what a key part of this mission is that the stand-in client satellite, the small piece of dummy debris, has a magnet on it. Well, has a plate that has a ferromagnetic material, so it can be captured with a magnet. And one of our main proposals in terms of mitigating the amount of debris in orbit is that satellites that launch should have these docking mechanisms on them. This makes it easier for us to plan out how to remove them or service them when the mission is over or if they need servicing. It will reduce the cost. It'll allow us to be able to do more in terms of volume production. And that's a really key step is getting these docking plates put on satellites. And that's what's really important that we're focused on that we can do.
So existing satellites don't have this, so then you could not do this with an existing satellite?
No, that's a key point. And that's our different... we have basically four primary mission lines. And so as I'm describing that first one, satellites that put on a docking plate before they launch, that's basically the prevention of future debris. So it's satellites that haven't launched, make sure you put the docking plate on. We'll go up and service you and remove you from orbit. What you just mentioned, David, is the satellites that are currently there, and that's reduction of current debris. So that's going up there and grabbing satellites that are pieces of debris, whether upper stage rocket bodies or defunct satellites, and removing those as a threat from orbit. As you mentioned, we can't use that magnetic capture. So what we're doing is another thing that we've done a lot of work on since we last talked is developing a robotic capture capability. So something that where we wouldn't be able to capture with a magnet, but using robotic arms. And we're working on various capabilities for capturing debris that's currently in orbit. We would use a lot of the same software capabilities, a lot of the same components, and a lot of the same capabilities of visual and robotic identification that we're using on our current mission. But we'd have to have a different capture capability.
I have a first email question for you from listener Todd, who's
great.
In San Diego. And he says, we always hear that there's a problem in capturing this debris because of the liability and who owns it. How have you addressed these legal issues?
It's such a great question, Todd, and it's one that we really focus on a lot. I say often that we're not just a technology company. We're looking at the complete spectrum of what we need to do to solve this problem. And one of the key aspects of this is liability and regulatory issues. So when a satellite launches right now or an upper stage rocket body, there is no salvage law like there is in the oceans, where if a craft is abandoned, it is basically open for whoever goes in and claims it. That doesn't exist in orbit. So when something is launched, it's in perpetuity connected to the launching state that launched it. So we couldn't just go up and grab an object that was launched by a company or a country that did not give us permission to grab it. So right now we are only focused on addressing those pieces of debris where we, of course, have the permission to go over and observe it and grab it. And so that issue of liability and policy is one that we have a strong team working on, and based outside of London, based in D.C., based in Tokyo. We have teams in all three of those places that is talking about domestic regulatory environment, talking about international cooperation among groups like the UN, World Economic Forum, talking about international industry groups focused on this. So it's a primary issue that we're trying to address. I don't know if I answered your question, Todd, because the answer is we're working on it. there isn't a very clear answer right now as to how this is going to work out. But where we see some really positive trends is there's so much attention being paid to it now. People are aware of it. People aren't ignoring it. People recognize the issues around it and are taking the steps to address not just the technical engineering issues behind this, but the political and regulatory ones.
Are launching states opposed to your grabbing it, or is it just a matter of how to work out what you're doing?
I think more the latter, David. It's working out, the intentions, it's all about communication and dialogue on all of this, and it depends on the state, of course. And to be clear, we actually have a mission with the Japanese Space Agency, JAXA, to go up and characterize one of their upper stage rocket bodies. So they are very in favor of trying to take these first steps to reduce the debris population in orbit. This is another one that has come up since we last spoke. At the beginning of 2020, we received a contract from the Japan Space Agency, JAXA, to go characterize. So just take pictures. Just understand all of the aspects of this upper stage rocket body in orbit, not to grab onto it. Take pictures of it. And then that's the first phase of what would be a two-phase mission, the second phase of which would be to go and grab it. And that second phase hasn't been approved yet by the Japanese government, so we are not the contractor for that yet. But, of course, we're interested in being so when that comes through, which we expect sometime in the next year or so. So the Japanese government is an example of a government that is wanting to do this. They are giving permission. They want to have these kind of missions to characterize and remove pieces of debris. And the European Space Agency as well is doing that. They have a mission that they have awarded to a company in Europe called ClearSpace, where they're going to go up and remove an upper stage piece of European debris, upper stage rocket body. So there are government agencies that are giving permission to do this and looking for this debris removal capability as a long-term commercial capability. So that's out there. There's two examples. There's going to be more.
You have another one question. Helen is in Seattle, and Helen says, with the funds that you're raising, are you going to be a publicly traded company? Are you thinking of being on an exchange-traded fund or something like that?
Thanks for asking, Helen. It's a very popular topic of conversation these days. If you're following all of the space SPACs that are out there and SPACs for those who aren't aware, I assume many of your listeners are, but these special purpose acquisition corporation, I think.
Right.
A way for these early stage revenue innovative companies who are at the front end of really getting toward profitability, how they can become publicly traded companies. There's a bunch that are out there. We've seen a lot of them, Virgin Galactic, Mentis, Astra. There's I don't know, seven or eight over the last couple of years that have gone public via SPAC. We currently don't have that specific plan. But you know, as with any startup, this is a discussion that we're talking about. So nothing in the works as of now. But we're considering a variety of next steps.
So I'm looking at some of the notes that I got from Allison, and she has it marked like end of life services, so that's Elsa D, and Address is Japan, and Elsa Malti is the UK. What's out of the United States? I know you mentioned doing GEO. Is there a name for that program? Is that the Lexi program?
That's it. You got it all. Allison did a great job in her prep work, as usual, David. We ran through our mission lines. And you're right. We talked through the Elsa D mission and the Address mission, which is a mission that we're doing with the Japan Space Agency. Before I get to the U.S., I'll just touch on the U.K. mission that you mentioned, which is Elsa M. We recognize that we cannot just be removing one piece of debris at a time. That is economically not viable. Paying for launch, paying for the development of a bus to only remove one piece of debris. So what our team in the U.K. has been focused on is developing a satellite system that can remove multiple pieces of debris. So go grab a piece of debris, bring it down to a lower altitude, release it so it will burn up in the atmosphere quickly, you know, below a space station, then go back up and grab another piece. Now, as I think many of your listeners know, that requires a tremendous amount of delta V, which is very difficult. So we need to build up a system that allows for orbital maneuvering in an efficient way to go grab multiple pieces of debris. So that's what our UK team is working on. They're actually working on the first few phases of a contract with the UK Space Agency, European Space Agency, and OneWeb to develop a mission that would eventually prove this capability in orbit. So a lot of work being done by our UK team on that mission. On the U.S. side, yes, that's the GEO life extension, and we call that LEXI, life extension in orbit. And the LEX as a mission line, it's going to be very similar to what Northrop Grumman Space Logistics has done with Intelsat. Again, for those who don't know, Space Logistics, a subsidiary of Northrop Grumman, went up and attached to an Intelsat satellite in orbit, and basically did a station keeping, extending the life of that satellite. So we have a similar capability that we're working on within the Israeli company working on the payload, and then our U.S. As the oversight of the Israeli company working on the mission overall. So that's our fourth then mission line.
What do you use for launchers, or is it all over the board, or how are you getting up to wherever you need to go?
So for SFD, we used Soyuz. We launched from Kazakhstan in March. We were a secondary payload. In that one, we were going up to this altitude of about 550 kilometers. We didn't have a target or a client that we were aiming at specifically. So we could basically be dropped off kind of wherever in the certain altitude. We had an altitude target that we wanted to be at, but we didn't have a specific location orbitally. So it was easy to go with as a secondary payload. For future missions, when we have a specific client that we're going after at a specific altitude and inclination, using the newer dedicated launch providers, the Rocket Labs, Virgin Orbits. I mean, there's a bunch that are on the cusp here: Astra, Relativity, Firefly. Using, you know, one of those to be able to say we need to go to that altitude, that inclination at this time is what we have to look at. So we are looking at those options for our future missions and aren't ready to announce any of those just yet, but talking to a variety of those for future mission operations. You know, that there's obviously a cost differential there. The cost per kilogram of taking those dedicated launch vehicles is significantly more than taking serving as a secondary payload on one of the larger launch vehicles. But there's that trade-off. If we get dropped off at an altitude or inclination that's not where we want to be, then it's going to be delta V to get to that. So we're balancing all of those costs right now as we look at these future missions, both the Address mission and the Elsa M mission, and then It's actually a bit different because it's a GEO, but we're having to balance a lot of those.
So to get to GEO, are you thinking of the smaller dedicated launchers too, or ride sharing with one of the bigger launchers?
Probably the latter on getting to GEO. It's a different mission. The size of our satellite mass will be different. And the dedicated launchers, there's not a lot that are going to GEO with the dedicated launchers these days. But we're looking at a variety of options there. But being a secondary payload or an additional payload on one of the larger launch vehicles looks to be making more sense there.
Listeners, you can give us a call. Let me give out our number again, 1-866-687-7223. Email remains, which is what you're all using tonight, Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. Again, it is a talk show. We do like to talk. So give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. So you mentioned Northrop Grumman, and I know we've got some more to get through. So you obviously have competition in this field, correct? You're not alone, are you?
Oh, well, we're not. And we're looking at two fairly different services. We see ourselves as one of the few, if the only one, that's offering services at different altitudes, from LEO to GEO, offering these RPO, rendezvous proximity operations, and satellite servicing at various altitudes. So if we're looking at the GEO, yes, Northrop Grumman is the first mover. They're there, and they've demonstrated success, and it is fantastic for the industry. We have lots of friends and colleagues over there at Space Logistics and Northrop Grumman, and we're very happy to see the success that they've done twice now with their missions into GEO. But we think that the market there is certainly big enough for multiple providers, and that's why we're aiming to be the second mover in that space. So Northrop is there as a competitor in the GEO belt. Not a lot of others that are focused on doing the satellite servicing in GEO. There's a few that are looking at doing GEO space situational awareness, so in situ missions that just observe in GEO, but actually docking and servicing satellites in GEO, we don't see a whole lot of competition, a whole lot of companies out there besides ourselves and Northrop. Down at the LEO, mostly debris removal, but also orbital transfer, we do see some more competition. We do see other companies, some that have taken a few steps, some that are really at the front end, a few people and a great idea and a PowerPoint, which is where we were 8 years ago. But we see a few more companies popping up like that. And that also is great. I mean, David, that just validates the market to such a degree. And one of the things when I joined the company, which was about 4 years ago, and certainly when our founder and CEO started it 8 years ago, was this question of, well, come on, there's not really a market. Who's going to pay for debris removal and satellite servicing? This is unrealistic what you guys are thinking of. We contended throughout that there is going to be a market, and we do see this changing. Certainly for life extension services in GEO, but also for debris removal, you see that this is coming. And the fact that we have all of these other companies that are trying to do the same thing, it tells us we were right. There's a market there. Now, we're still at the front end of it. It's still nascent. The on-orbit servicing market for space is still not big, but it's going to be there, and it's growing. And to close this question out, I just point to a group that I'm actually the chair of right now, which is called CONFERS, which is a consortium of companies. It's an industry consortium that is focused on developing standards and best practices for on-orbit servicing. When this group started, funded initially by DARPA from DoD in the U.S., there were six or seven companies that were part of this that were saying, okay, yeah, we should focus on satellite servicing as a business, and how can we develop some standards and best practices. That was in 2018. We're now 3 years later, and there's 50. There's 50 companies that are members of CONFERS and growing. And so we are continuing to expand the membership of CONFERS and the broader focus of CONFERS as an industry group And that's exciting to see. And that shows that that there's competition and that there's a market. And it's going to be big enough to serve a lot of these companies that are looking at this service.
You have a caller waiting on hold. Good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you? And thank you for calling.
This is Marshall.
Hi there, Marshall.
I'm just thinking about the ultimate debris problem to clean up, and that's going to be the International Space Station whenever they decide to turn it off. Have you had any fun discussions on how to get that done?
hey, Marshall. No, is the short answer. We have not had any fun discussions with NASA or any other agencies on that. You know, ISS is a big one, literally, figuratively, all of it. It's pretty low, though. It's pretty low altitude. So ISS is at about 400 kilometers. So if they don't, if the ISS doesn't have a thrust to boost it a couple times a year, that would come down and enter the atmosphere in, I don't know what the numbers would be, but let's say 6 months to a year, maybe a little bit more about that time frame, though. You know, somebody with more understanding can correct me on that, but it wouldn't be long. It wouldn't be long. And if we're looking at the impact that that would have to other satellites in orbit, it would be minimal because it's so low, and so many of the satellites that we're looking to protect are higher, you know, 500, 550, you know, big orbital bands, all with Starlink. SpaceX, for example, is about 550. You go up to about 800. You've got another pretty crowded orbital highway there. And then up to about 1,000 is where OneWeb is now launching into. So all of those are above the ISS. So if that would be deorbited, it's not going to have a risk of colliding with and impacting a lot of those satellites that are higher, and any debris that would come down from that would then come down and burn up in the atmosphere. The other topic, which I won't get into, is not, you know, I used to work for NASA. I don't anymore, so I'll let the people at NASA answer these questions, is when that comes in, how much of that would be would burn up in the atmosphere, and how much of it would reenter the atmosphere at all, and then there's those questions of impact to the Earth. But I know there's a lot of smart people at NASA who are talking about that, and there's people who are thinking of how to either extend, repurpose, do something else with the ISS. It's been an incredible investment. When I was with NASA, I used to say it's one of the modern wonders of the world. If we start saying, you know, what are the seven wonders of the world, ISS should be up there.
Thank you. That was fun.
Anything else, Marshall?
No, that was the big one. Is I would think you'd have to take it, literally take the space station apart, and then drop each piece in, and,
yeah.
You know, there have to be some control to it. But, hey,
there would.
If it's simply just let it junk itself, they just might do it. Until next time.
Thank you, Marshall.
We'll see. Yeah, great, Marshall. Thanks.
Hey, I would hope they find a way to save it as something, maybe start a museum in space or something. I don't know, but I'd hate to see it thrown away. I
agree, David, and I'll give a shout out to someone named Alice Gorman, who is a space archaeologist based in Australia. If those who don't know her, she's great, and she focuses on that kind of that question itself. We have so many historical assets in space, and how do we save them? And that's something that's actually another step. You know, we're talking about all of this that we were already talking about, David, is what we're doing in the next few years. But if we start looking out toward the next 10 years and beyond, I mean, there's going to be so many applications for the technology we're developing.
Uh-oh, did we lose you? Are you there? Listeners, we're on a cell phone, so we may have lost him. Are you there? Okay, I'm going to call back. Listeners, you're going to have dead air for a minute, so just sit tight, and we will call back, okay? Don't go anywhere. Listeners, we're back with Chris, and apologize for that phone line glitch, and welcome back.
you're talking about, I guess, the space station and saving it as a museum. I wish we had done that with Mir, but that didn't happen. So maybe they'll figure out how to do that with the ISS.
Yeah, it'll be great to do. And I think, as I was saying, I was talking about, I mentioned Alice Gorman as a space archaeologist and thinking about the different ways that we can use the technology that we're working on. And it's not just for satellite life extension and for debris removal. There's going to be multiple ways we can do this as we're looking at this space economy, which is just going to grow so much. What else we can use this in terms of recycling debris, in terms of manufacturing in orbit, in terms of how can we apply these capabilities toward a human spaceflight. You see what's happening now with the likes of Branson and Musk and Bezos, doing what they're doing. That's going to continue. They were just going to the tip of the atmosphere. There's going to be more space tourism. And so how can we continue to look at how to dock with and service satellites and beyond, both in LEO, in GEO, and up to cislunar orbit and beyond. So we are at the front end of what I think is going to be a game-changing technologies in rendezvous proximity operations and satellite servicing that will have applications far beyond what we're even thinking about right now. So we're really excited, not just about the next 5 years and what's going to happen, but about the next 15, 20.
Roger has a similar question. He's in Denver. And he says, are you looking down the road where you could service satellites and orbital material around the moon or Mars?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, the same kind of capability that we're developing and that we've begun to prove out in LEO with our ELSA-D mission is applicable to cislunar and Martian orbits as well. So we are looking at all of those applications. And we think the capability and the demonstration that we as a private company, a commercially-minded private company, can bring to this conversation is significant and really game-changing. I mean, what we've seen up until now are governments, institutional funding for these kind of missions. If we start bringing the private sector in there, it's gonna change the game. And so that's what we think that we're on the front end of. And the applications don't stop at LEO, they don't stop at GEO, they don't stop at cislunar. They keep going, and we're excited to continue to play a part in this.
So you have been playing a role internationally with sustainability and the space debris issue. You said a little while ago, it's getting more and more awareness and more attention. And I see you got noted in the G7 meeting. So they're looking at space debris and sustainable space issues at the G7 and some of these other world economic meetings and platforms.
You know, that's such an important point to bring up. And I thank you for doing so, David. I mean, that's big. When you get the leaders of the G7 nations to agree on anything, that's a big deal. They all have, decided that this is an important enough issue to highlight. And so the fact that in Cornwall earlier this year at the G7 meeting, that they all got together and said, yeah, we need to band together and find a way to ensure space sustainability going forward. And that includes active debris removal missions, and it includes focusing on these kind of technologies that will help sustain space, that's an important step. So when we get buy-in from the top like that, and then we get the groundswell of smaller companies who are starting to focus on this, that's a great combination. And so we see a lot working from the bottom up, from the top down, and we're going to see, I think, a massive convergence on how the market grows based on that kind of input. And so getting government buy-in is big, and we're getting it, which is really great.
Does high interest rates and inflation and issues with not just the U.S. but the global economy, do they pose risk for your business, or are you sort of, at least for the time being, immune to those challenges?
So far, we're okay with that, but that's always a risk that we keep on our risk register. It's one that we don't have much control over, of course, but we have to prepare for how we can deal with that. It has impacts, as we've seen. It has impacts on materials and sourcing materials and supply chain, and it also has risks on government funding of missions. You know, we see this as imperative, as finding a solution towards space sustainability, making significant investments in technology development. We see this as essential. And we see that a lot of governments are recognizing that as well. But it is still not at the highest priority of a lot of governments. So in an economic downturn, the risk that this kind of funding is on the chopping block, yes, that is high. So we need to continue to really focus on how we reduce costs, how we as a company and an industry remain sustainable going forward through any of these kind of fluctuations in global economy or political changes, continuing to highlight how important this is and making sure that we can withstand all of this. It's something that's certainly on our minds.
You're over there in the heart of Asia. What's the interest in China and India? Those are two big space programs and space countries. And so do you have relationships with both? Are they interested in what you're doing? Do they have their own plans and own ideas for solving some of these problems?
They're both huge countries with growing space programs, but certainly they're at different levels in terms of their space development, China being much farther advanced. India is doing a lot, as we've seen with the launch of so many satellites that they've continued in their capability and launch vehicles, and their contribution toward a variety of missions. So India is doing a lot, but if we look at them separately, certainly China's farther ahead. China is still a bit opaque. We don't have a great visibility into a lot of what they're doing, and we do not have right now discussions with Chinese entities on this topic. I've seen that there are a few companies that are looking at aspects of servicing within China, but we frankly don't know too much about that. We are really focused on developing the technologies, developing the policies internationally on the countries where we're located, Japan, UK, with an extension into Europe, and the US, and Israel now. We're really focused on those right now in terms of where we do our technical development and our policy development, and then hoping that once we can get some kind of set standards, that we can make steps there, we will look at further cooperation. That goes for India as well. We are not really talking to many in India either, but the market there is still a bit nascent in terms of where we might find some customers, but open to continuing to talk with India a little bit more.
Well, the commercial activity is sprouting up all over the place with Australia, New Zealand, the UAE, you know, lots of places. So depending on where the launches are going to take place, I guess that would have a lot to do with where you'd probably have to access space, where your access points would be, right? Not necessarily the country itself.
Good point. I shouldn't say that we're exclusively focused on the several countries that I mentioned. Certainly, Australia, New Zealand, UAE. Canada, of course, is doing things. So there's a lot of countries that are focused on this that we are continuing to have conversations with. And there's both commercial development in all of those countries at various levels, from launch capability to satellite development to various ground station activities, communications, as well as political interest. Looking at countries like New Zealand, which is very environmentally minded in a lot of ways, that environmentally conscious mindset extends to orbit. So there's interest within New Zealand of making sure that there's an environmental push terrestrially and orbitally. You look at other countries, and there's a focus politically on this as well. So yes, technically, politically, talking with these other countries is important. And then bringing them all together on multinational activities, I mentioned earlier, things like the UN or things like World Economic Forum and industry groups like CONFERS, those are all international efforts beyond just the countries that we're based in.
You have an email from Jordan in Dallas, Texas, and he says, do you have any projection as to when you might have an operational commercial system? And who is your actual customer? Is it a nation state? Is it the company that originally launched the item that is now debris? I'm not clear who your customer would be.
Very typical question, Jordan. Thanks for asking. It's going to depend a bit on the service that we're offering. So to answer your second question first, it's going to depend on the service. And when we look at our GeoLife extension, the customer is quite clear. It's the satellite operator, commercial or government, the satellite operator that wants to extend the life of its satellite in GEO. Our value proposition is quite clear. That satellite is coming toward the end of its life. It's either it is not able to provide the revenue to the company that launched it. We offer a service to go over there and keep it revenue positive by station keeping, attaching to it, and making sure that asset remains revenue positive longer, and giving the company itself a little more flexibility to decide what to do next. They don't have to decide to invest several hundred million dollars in a new satellite. They can extend the life of the one that's already there, then make some decisions on how to do the capital capital expenditure to build a new one or not. So we give them a lot of flexibility there. So we think the value proposition for the GEO life extension is quite clear. I think what is Jordan's probably referring to is more on the low Earth orbit side, who's going to pay for removing this debris. And there, too, we see different customer bases. The debris that's currently there, the upper stage rocket bodies, the defunct satellites in orbit, those were mostly put up by governments, and government with the responsibility of continuing to protect the access to space data of its citizens has an interest in starting to remove those pieces of debris. And so that's the meshings I mentioned with the Japan Space Agency, JAXA, with the European Space Agency in Europe. Those missions, one of which we had a contract for to go up and characterize and eventually remove a piece of debris, we see the government as the customer. So we're focused on the government as a customer for that removal of current debris. For the mitigation of future debris, which is what the magnet capture capability I talked about at the start of the interview here, we see commercial as the eventual customers there. As more and more companies are launching these constellations of satellites in the hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands in some cases, there's got to be an incentive there to protect that orbital environment. If a company has launched 1,000 satellites into a specific orbit, they're going to be crossing. There's going to be a risk to the assets that are in orbit there. And when there is a collision in that orbit, then that creates more debris, which creates more risk. So there's an incentive for these companies to remove their debris. And so we're focused on articulating that reduction in risk that would come from removing the debris that's up there. So to summarize, Jordan, to the question of who the customer is, we see both commercial and government depending on the service and on the orbit. Now, the first part of your question, when do we expect to have that commercially repeatable service? We're looking mid-decade. So in the next few years, we're still at the point of proving out the capability. We think that once we prove out these capabilities and the various missions that we're building, we're going to see the interest climb. And so we're looking at starting to see this commercial viability mid to late decade. And by the 2030s, by 2030 really, we want to see this as a normal thing. Going up and servicing a satellite, removing the satellite debris, we want to see it as being nothing that takes a big interview or a big headline in a newspaper saying we've proved it. It's just going to be what happens. Of course, satellite operators will prepare their satellites for future servicing and debris removal. Of course, there's going to be servicing in space. Why wouldn't there be? So I'm looking at, 10 to 15 years in the future, this being a people look back and be like, wow, you mean there was a time when we didn't prepare satellites, or there was a time when we didn't clean up our debris? That's shocking. That's the kind of mindset I think we're going to get to eventually.
So maybe 7 years or so to become commercially routine in LEO.
Commercially routine in LEO, yeah, end of the decade. By 2030 is where we'd like to be commercially routine. That is not big news that a satellite piece of debris was removed or serviced.
So are you also going to provide tug service and maybe changing orbits? If I know it takes a lot of Delta V, but helping to move maybe a launched rideshare to where it needs to go? Is that part of what your services are going to be?
Sure. Why not? I mean, and you're articulating exactly what we talk about internally, David, when we're looking at our future strategies. We don't typically include that in our four service lines, but yes, we've lately started to add that as we talk, because all we're doing when we are working to deorbit a piece of debris, we're just changing its orbit. So it's just the application of additional delta V to change the orbit of that object. So yeah, could we do that to raise an orbit, to bring if a satellite gets dropped off at a place where it wasn't intended or it needs to move somewhere? Certainly we can do that. What we bring is that capability to do the rendezvous and prox ops, where we can find that. We don't have to launch with the satellite to be able to raise it to that other orbit. We can go and locate it and attach to it and then raise it up in the future if there was any kind of problem, or change it or bring it to another location. So certainly that orbital transfer capability is something that we are focused on as well.
Listeners, there's still time if you would like to call. The phone number is 1-866-687-7223. I always get this question when I do these shows. Are you hiring in your U.S. office, and what positions do you usually hire for?
Our U.S. office, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, has grown from one person to 35 in the last 2.5 years, and it's going to continue to grow. We do have openings. You can find it at astroscale.com. You can see there's a site on hiring and what the open positions are. We're looking for a variety of positions. Offhand, I can't recall all of them, but in the technical arena, certainly we're trying to internalize capabilities in computer vision and robotics, internalize capability in software development. Are really key aspects of what we want to do. And so there are a significant amount of positions that are open globally. I assume people, you have listeners around the world, there are going to be openings, and there's going to be activity in all of our offices. So certainly go online and look there and send us a note if you're interested, because we're always looking for passionate, smart, excited, positive people to join this mission.
Do they have to be in the engineering field, or are other disciplines doable as well?
Other disciplines are doable. This is a global problem that requires global contributions, not just from different nationalities, but from different capabilities. We are solving a serious technical problem, but this is a serious policy problem. It is a communications problem, David. I mean, you having this radio show, you know well about the importance of telling a good story and getting out there and communicating an issue. We need those people too. We think we have a compelling, exciting story to tell, both about what we offer now and what we're planning to offer in the future. So, yeah, we need people to explain that. This is a legal issue, as one of the questions that came in asked about. So this isn't just a technical problem. We are covering a bunch of different bases, and it's an internal issue. So people with administrative or financial capabilities as well. We're scaling at an incredible rate. So we need to solve a lot of problems, a lot of issues internally as we scale. So we need people from capabilities ranging from engineering and technical to administrative and legal and communications and policy and all of that. So, we're always excited to talk again to people who are excited about this mission.
You have an email from Darren in Phoenix, and Darren says, I'm curious as to what you do globally on cyber. It seems to me that there's a lot of nefarious actors in the world, and you have a lot of software and a lot of computer power and communications software and hardware that would be a nice target for people to do bad things with, especially as you're trying to latch on to a piece of debris and maybe have it go haywire. Do you have a cyber defense program? Is this something you pay a lot of attention to, or are you possibly too small to worry about it right now?
Such prescient, important questions that the listeners are asking. And this one particularly is one that, as we started out, as Darren alluded to, as we started out, we were small, and that was not our priority. We had a lot of other issues that we were trying to solve. But we recognized a few years ago that this is something that we can't ignore. We always knew it was there, but recognized that we needed to take action on it. And so we hired someone based out of our UK offices who was our cyber guru, and he's there to address these exact questions that Darren was asking about and think about how we solve them. We're still at an early stage on solving it, but it's a high priority for me. And when I talk to our cyber person in the UK, I always reiterate this is something we really want to highlight and prioritize because of all the reasons that Darren mentioned. This is, it's not something that we like to think about, but we have to. And this is a concern, and we need to be on the front end of addressing it. And so we are now taking the steps to make sure we do.
Are you finding it that it's getting more and more attention in the space arena and what you're doing from other players, other governments, other companies, and like that committee that's grown to 50 people that you spoke about earlier?
The attention is incredible. I mean, from the G7, which you mentioned, David, to Confers, which you just referenced, that has now 50 members, 50 companies that are joined in, to this proliferation of various working groups or, subsets of international organizations, which now have a space sustainability subcommittee or a group that, various universities are coming up with initiatives that say, okay, we're going to gather different players in the commercial and government sector to talk about how we assure long-term space environment management. So many of these groups, and one of the things that we're focused on at Astroscale is being a leading voice in that. And so I mentioned I'm the chair of this group that confers. Our CEO, Nobu, is a vice president of the International Astronautical Federation. He's also on the World Economic Foundation that has a group of that's focused on space leadership and specifically on space sustainability. Under that guise, the World Economic Forum started an issue on the space, something called the Space Sustainability Rating. So putting some kind of metrics toward how satellite makers can practice sustainability. Do they have certain aspects to their satellite which will make it sustainable? A rating system on that. So these are just a couple examples of the multitude of things that are out there. I think our biggest challenge is trying to manage and consolidate and make sure we're on the same page and there's not a bunch of people talking past each other. So one of the things we talk about internally is, okay, how do we organize all these groups that we're on and all these groups that are popping up to talk about this so we're not having inefficient conversations but having directed and targeted discussion on how we can solve these things. So short answer to your question, yes, there's a significant amount of interest on this.
So I hear popular, not space, but popular radio and TV shows all the time, and I hear them mention this horrible problem about space debris that we're heading toward a Kepler moment? Not Kepler, you know what I'm...
Kessler syndrome
moment. And they leave the impression that it's chaotic and nothing's really being done. Okay, so I understand these are general audience shows and that the MCs or the announcers or whoever's doing it is probably reading a script that somebody wrote for him or her that may or may not know what they're talking about. So I understand all of that. But it seems to me that something is missing. You mentioned telling a good story. You really do have a good story, and Northrop Grumman has a good story to tell, but somehow it doesn't penetrate into a big way into popular storytelling about space and different issues about space, which maybe just for the nature of being popular, sort of like to focus on the drama, even if the drama's way over exaggerated. So is it important to get your story out into the general public, or is the general public just not that significant and not worth the resources right now for sort of a startup emerging company? Because I know you have to be careful how you deploy resources, but the general public is woefully ignorant. And so I'm just wondering, I'm sure you realize that, but I'm just wondering, If you target that for educational outreach or anything like that.
Definitely. We want people to be aware of this issue. And to your point, we don't want to sensationalize it or make it seem like the sky is falling, you know, literally. We don't want to over-exaggerate it, because then we lose credibility if we say,
right,
Esser syndrome, tomorrow we're all going to die. You can't talk to your family anymore. So that we're not trying to say that. What we are saying is this is a low probability, but extremely high impact event. If something happens, if there are collisions, and there have been, and there will be. And so what we want to get people aware of is just that this is a growing environmental concern, and it could have an impact on many aspects of our lives. So if something does happen, or I should say when something does happen, because it's going to at some point in the future. There will be an accident. The question of how bad it is. It's going to impact us. And what we'd like the general public to be aware of is, first of all, how reliant we are on the space environment. And the orbital highway seems like it's far away. We don't see it every day. We don't see it at all. We don't think about it. I think the general population doesn't even think about the fact that when they do a banking transaction, or use some kind of GPS service, or now using self-driving cars or IoT capabilities, don't really think about the impact that space has on those activities. What we'd like to convey to the general public is there's a significant impact. In fact, a lot of the stuff we do and take for granted couldn't be done without the data from space. And that's only going to continue. Our reliance on that data from space is only going to increase. And as that reliance on space data increases and this orbital environment becomes more crowded, the risk gets higher. The risk of a potential collision gets higher because there's more stuff in space and more potential debris in space. And then the impact from that collision gets more impactful. So we're not trying to say that this is we're at a life and death situation. But we are trying to say that all of these issues are increasing and we're very reliant on this. And if we don't take action now, then there's going to be an impact down the line, and particularly on future generations. So I don't want to be the one who, when my two children ask me in 20 years, how come we polluted space to the degree that it can't be used anymore, what were we doing about it? I want to be able to say, yeah, we tried to solve that problem. And we did. What I want to say is we did solve that problem. And so that's the kind of story we want to make sure that the general public is aware of. And we don't want to sensationalize it, but we do want to make sure that people are aware and that we start to take action.
Do you let people know the progress you're making? Do you tell that story into the general public?
We try to as much as we can, David. I doing things like this, speaking to your listeners, I probably speak several times a month on similar type of calls, as does my CEO, as does the teams around the world. So yeah, we're out there trying to spread the word, and we're always looking for opportunities to tell the story and spread the word about how important it is now, the impact it's going to have long term, and how it's going to really change all aspects of our satellite service. You know, going to change the future of the space environment. So we're out there trying to tell our story. We have a newsletter that comes out every month, and that we talk about all the things we're doing. So you can subscribe to that newsletter again on our website, Astroscale com, and there's a click down on outreach, and there's a newsletter subscription. Always talks about all the things we're doing and gives you more information and access about what's happening. So, yeah, we really hope that that people, this continues to resonate with people, and they continue to spread the word to their friends and family and continue to talk about it. That's what we want to look for.
We're pretty close coming up on the end of the program. Is there something we've missed that we should have covered or that you want us to know about either the industry or your operations or what you guys are doing?
I would say that you covered it pretty well. You and the listeners with your questions covered pretty well what we're doing and where we see this going. I'd end just by saying we're excited. We're excited with the demonstration that we proved out a couple weeks ago in orbit. We're excited about the vast possibilities that are going to be coming from satellite servicing and the capabilities that we're developing. And we're excited about the space economy as a whole. I'll note that I was in the U.S. at a conference last week in Colorado, the Space Symposium. First conference attended in 20 months, and people were excited to be back together at a safe distance and trying to make sure that we all obviously practiced COVID-safe activities. But there was a palpable sense of excitement that even with the uncertainties and problems of the last year and a half, the space economy is continuing to move forward. And so there's a lot of excitement about this, and we're really happy to play a leading role in it.
Well, I keep getting the newsletter, so I'm sure we will talk again.
Great.
And I look forward to it and keep going, and it's exciting to follow your progress and to be able to talk to you about every year. I probably would have talked more frequently if it weren't for COVID, but let's hope that's behind us or on the way to being behind us. And
let's hope so.
Absolutely, and I look forward to meeting you at a coming space conference too. So we will stay in touch.
I hope so, David.
And again, I want to thank Allison for the great job in getting me information and helping to put this show together. A real treasure. So you want to hold on to that one. And
I agree.
We'll keep following you, and we'll talk to you again soon. And I'm glad we know you, and I'm glad you're doing great work. It's very, very important. So keep it up.
David, thanks for the support, man, and thanks to the listeners for joining in, and we look forward to talking again soon. Please keep in touch.
Absolutely, and listeners, come back Friday and Sunday for our regular space show programs. They're all on our newsletter, and we're listener-supported, so we can certainly appreciate your support, and we're a 501c3 nonprofit. More information about that, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And I wish all of you a great week. It's a young week, so stay healthy and safe. Always keep looking up. And goodbye from Chris, David, and the Space Show.